This is the IBJ Podcast for the week of October 18th, 2021. I'm your host, Mason King. Welcome back to the podcast, everybody. As you know, since its creation in 1909, the Indianapolis Motor Speedway has been a proving ground for automobile innovation. Ray Haroon, the winner of the first 500-mile race at the Brickyard, is believed to have invented the rear-view mirror, or at least the first one used in a race. That was 1911. Let's fast forward 110 years. Another historic first is scheduled for October 23rd at the track, a competition of state-of-the-art autonomous race cars driven entirely by computer programs written by 9 race teams. This is the Indy Autonomous Challenge. There will be no joysticks or remote control consoles, no human intervention. The open wheel cars will be outfitted with sophisticated sensors to provide a wealth of data on their surroundings and other elements. They then will rely on their programming to race around the oval at speeds that are expected to reach at least 100 miles per hour. The 9 teams will be vying for a prize purse of $1 million. Now, the challenge was concocted by the Indianapolis-based not-for-profit Energy Systems Network, and the network's mission is to develop the state's energy technology sector while promoting its manufacturing and research capabilities. As a result, it's deeply involved in mobility. Now, for the challenge, it hoped to bring together public, private, and academic institutions to challenge university students from around the world to invent and prove out a new generation of automated vehicle software. It initially attracted dozens of teams, which since have been whittled down to 9 entrants, and they include what you would consider the home team, Black and Gold Autonomous Racing, made up of students from Purdue University, IUPUI, and West Point. For this week's podcast, we'll speak with Paul Mitchell, President and CEO of the Energy Systems Network, about how the challenge will go down and what could come of it. And we'll also speak with Michael Saxon, Managing Director and Team Principal of Black and Gold Autonomous Racing, to get a sense of how they're gearing up for the challenge. I'd like to welcome to the podcast Paul Mitchell, President and CEO of the Energy Systems Network. Thank you for making time for us today.
Glad to be here.
So I've been trying to envision what this event will look like. So if I go to the track on October 23rd for the final competition, what will I see? I know there's a robot dog from Boston Dynamics that will be the official flag waver, which is good because I can get some buy-in from my five-year-old to go to this thing.
Exactly.
But then how does the competition unfold? What do we know at this point?
Well, first of all, what I'd say is that we've tried to make this event compelling from the moment you enter the Indianapolis Motor Speedway grounds until you leave. And so certainly the on-track competition is the pinnacle of the day. But for people that will be there, the gates open at 10 in the morning, and we have companies from around the world that are leaders in robotics and automation, including, as you suggested, Boston Dynamics, that's bringing Spot, their robot dog, as well as some other robots, but lots of other companies. Cisco is our presenting sponsor, Luminar and others, as well as our 9 competing teams, which are made up of 21 universities, will be occupying the gasoline alley garages. So if people are familiar with the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, people sometimes refer to these as the F1 garages because they were built during the time when F1 was running at the track. And so in those garages, there'll be interactive displays that fans can come and see, can interact with and learn from. And then in terms of the on-track activities, you know, we're going to have, you know, an opening ceremony that will, I don't want to give away all the details yet because we may have more to say, but it's going to sort of mirror some of the pomp and circumstance that you see at the Indy 500, but with some unique features like a robot flag waving dog and some other things that will be familiar, but sort of a new spin on the old familiar. And then the competition itself, it's high speed, fully autonomous race cars, no human interaction. We've had teams that are in excess of 100 miles per hour, and we expect them to be you know, that or faster going around the track. And we know that our competition will be compelling. We haven't announced the final rule set yet, but we're working on that. But we know that it'll be high speed laps, autonomous teams competing with each other. And at the end, we plan to give out $1 million in prize purse to the winners of the competition.
I know the original objective was to have head-to-head racing.
Yeah,
cars competing on the track at the same time, but that might not be the case this time.
Yeah, it's really too soon to say, and I know that sounds crazy because it's only, you know, a week out, but our teams are quite literally, you know, day by day, hour by hour, progressing where they're at. We have had teams that have been on the track at the same time and have been doing passing. We're trying to see whether or not we're at a point where that is a reliably consistent outcome and something that would be entertaining and compelling. We know that one car on the track at a time is, and we've been doing that for several months now at increasing speeds. So we started out 40, 50 miles an hour, which isn't all that exciting, and up to 100. Now it starts to get very exciting. So whether or not we have more than one car on the track at the same time to be determined, to the extent we do, it's going to be, you know, two cars and passing in sort of a passing competition. What we're not going to have, and we just aren't there yet from a technology validation standpoint, is, you know, all the teams on the track at the same time, you know, racing each other at full speed.
Do you have a sense of how you determine who wins?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think we haven't released the final rule set, but what I can say is that, you know, speed is going to matter. We launched this competition to really validate multiple things, but two really important technical challenges of high-speed automation, right? Being able to operate a robot vehicle, in this case, a race car, autonomously at extreme high speeds, over 100 miles an hour, faster than you're supposed to at least be driving on the highway. And then a second one is to do that with, you know, close encounters with other robot-driven vehicles. And so I think our competition will include speed as well as perception. Those are the two kind of key functions. But I think in the end, you know, speed is going to play a key role in the determination of a winner.
So my understanding is Lilly Endowment provided a grant to help Energy Systems Network develop the autonomous challenge.
Correct. And
when was that? When did this process start?
In the spring of 2019, even beginning of 2019 is when we began the planning process. And that was actually supported and funded in part by some initial seed dollars from the Indiana Economic Development Corporation. So the state was in as really the first dollars to say, hey, you should investigate this and see if there's interest from industry, interest from the academic institutions that would need to be involved. Obviously, we needed interest from the Annapolis Motor Speedway. And then as we got into the fall of 2019, that's when we approached the endowment and we had a pretty compelling set of stakeholders that were interested: Indianapolis Motor Speedway, a number of companies that had signed on and showed interest, as well as a number of universities that were prepared to sign up for the competition if we could announce it. And so the endowment's grant to Energy Systems Network gave us the resources and the ability to say, we have the prize money, we have some dollars to get up and going. And that allowed us to announce the competition, you know, publicly, and the reception was tremendous. I mean, we had more than 41 universities sign up in February of 2020 to be involved in the competition. And many of those universities stuck with it all the way through, you know, the first year plus of the competition, which was really operated virtually with a lot of simulation competitions, sort of computer-based racing. Think of sort of video gaming, but at a much more advanced level. And so they got a lot of benefits out of it. And then the field of universities and the field of teams naturally reduced as we got to the point where your teams had to decide if they wanted to purchase a car and begin actual on-track validation and practice and begin, you know, running these race cars eventually at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway over the summer.
What's really interesting to me is, I mean, this is such a big idea, and it's an idea where you really have no clue what you're going to end up with. You just know. I mean, 2 years into the future, we're going to get inputs or outputs here that we're not expecting.
Yeah.
So what did you hope to get out of it at the beginning?
We wanted to do something at the Annapolis Motor Speedway And then the question was, well, what does that need to include? How do you create a competition that's compelling and that you'll get people to participate in? And there we really took a page from the DARPA Grand Challenge, which was held in 2005 and 2006. That challenge, also for $1 million, was organized by DARPA, which is part of the U.S. Department of Defense. And universities competed to develop then the first autonomous vehicles. And at that point, the goal was just to operate autonomous vehicles around a course out in the desert at very low speeds. But it worked in the sense that it got top research universities to focus on it, to get the talent to commit to, you know, building out the technology needed for that type of a competition. And it also attracted a lot of industry partners and sponsors, and in the end resulted in the creation of a lot of new IP. A lot of new companies were formed out of that. So our feeling was, if we could do something like the DARPA Grand Challenge, but do it at a compelling venue like the Indianapolis Motor Speedway instead of the middle of the desert in California, that we might be able to generate a lot of momentum and interest that would also have long-term benefits for the state of Indiana, and specifically around attracting top talent to the state, helping launch companies, helping connect sponsor companies to the state of Indiana, get some of our research universities involved. And, you know, I should note Purdue and IUPUI are combined on one of the teams that's competing. So there was a lot of goals and objectives that fit with things that the IEDC and the Lilly Endowment, you know, care about, and that frankly, Energy Systems Network, our organization, and the broader Central Indiana Corporate Partnership are involved in and care about.
So you have 9 teams that will be competing on the 23rd. All of the teams started with the same stuff, is my understanding. I mean, you eliminate variables by giving them all the same vehicle and the same hardware.
Correct.
So what do they start with?
So all 9 teams have this, essentially the same race car, right? And then what they're responsible for is developing and training and really, I'll use just to use racing terms, training and coaching the robot driver, which is the software that they develop. And these are basically algorithms that make decisions using artificial intelligence and machine learning to pilot these race cars.
That's the original work. I mean, that is where they differentiate themselves, is in the programming.
Correct.
I mean,
correct.
You could have 2 teams that have completely different approaches to that. It's up to
correct.
Them.
Yeah, we do. I mean, there's some base software building blocks that I think most of the teams are probably pretty consistent in how they approach. But then there's a lot of differentiation in how they approach the algorithms. And frankly, the teams bring a lot of experience and areas of research focus that some are maybe better at localization, which is trying to understand where the vehicle is at any given time on the track or on the course. Others may be better at obstacle detection or sensor fusion, basically the ability to take information from the sensors which are on the vehicle and determine whether an obstacle is real or if there's a mistake being made, whether that obstacle is a moving car or a barrier. And then, you know, also, you know, high speed decision making, basically high throughput decision making. Those are all, you know, different skills that are required. And some teams are better at one of those areas than others. You know, we've seen some teams that it seems pretty clear they're really good at going fast with a straight racing line. Other teams maybe are more competitive around, you know, overtaking and are really eager to get to the point of multi-vehicle passing because that's what their core competency is.
So who built the
car? But in terms, as you said, in terms of the vehicles, they're all the same. That was an important decision we made early on. Just to go back to the DARPA Grand Challenge, there the universities developed their own vehicles. So people showed up to the desert, some with a autonomous Humvee, others had, I think there was an autonomous motorcycle that was in that competition. I don't think it did very well, but it was, you know, got a lot of attention. And we talked at the beginning about whether this should be something where the universities develop their own vehicles and then run them at the track, or whether there should be a spec vehicle with common components and technology. And both the universities and frankly, acknowledging the limitations of what we could achieve in a 2-year period, came to the conclusion that developing a common vehicle made a lot of sense. And so the vehicle itself, you know, has state-of-the-art technology on it. It's I say it's off the shelf because it's technology that is supplied by industry it's just really cutting edge or bleeding edge technology. So, you know, our LiDAR supplier, Luminar, is a newer company, really the first to develop solid state LiDAR technology. And we have some of their first generation systems on our vehicles. They're working incredibly well, by the way. You know, Cisco is another big partner and sponsor, has a extreme low latency communication technology that allow vehicles to talk to the other vehicles, talk back to race control and infrastructure. And it's a new technology for Cisco. It's something they acquired recently and it's out in the commercial realm, but it's still very cutting edge. So it's a lot of bleeding edge commercial technology integrated into a race car platform that will be familiar to people. It's the Indy Lights chassis as kind of the base vehicle chassis provided by Dallara. Obviously, it's been augmented to the point where there's no driver in it. So it's the cockpit's filled with a supercomputer and a bunch of other sensors. But to the naked eye from a distance, you know, it looks like an Indy car or specifically an Indy Lights car.
If one of these cars crashes really badly, who has to pay for that?
The teams now, for a while, the IAC was kind of picking up the tab of accidents when we were still in the process of building vehicles. So, I mean, keep in mind, in the middle of the summer, because of the pandemic, you know, it was tough to get parts. And also some of the parts we're using are parts that are also used in the Indy Lights series. So you have Indy Lights teams that want a part for competing that weekend. And we want the part for our autonomous race cars to be able to practice. And, you know, you can imagine who wins out in that competition. You know, one needs it for a race the next weekend, the other just wants it to get our cars built for our competition. So, you know, there was a period of time where we only had, you know, four or five cars that were ready to go, but we had, you know, 9-10 teams that wanted to use those cars. And so they had to share those vehicles. And luckily we didn't have many accidents, haven't had many accidents. We've had a few. They largely result in the same type of damage. And the cars pretty much, I think almost in every instance, have been put back together, you know, within 24, 48 hours. And now we're at a point where the Indy Lights series is over. Dallara has plenty of spare parts ready to go, particularly going into next week where we have a lot of practicing and it'll be the higher speeds at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. I fully expect we may have, you know, an accident or two and need to get cars, you know, put back together quickly in order to have them run on the 23rd. Generally speaking, the accidents with sort of single car making a bad decision, you know, clipping the wall, hitting the wall, it does some damage, but it's stuff that can be repaired pretty quickly.
And how much is each car worth?
Well, you know, what we've said is that, you know, these cars are worth over $1 million. The benefit of this being a competition that is proving cutting edge technology is that a lot of the value, particularly the autonomous systems, the hardware, some of the software that allow the car to operate autonomously are being donated by sponsors. And also some of the more traditional parts of a car that you just assume is maybe not specific to automation, like Bridgestone is a major sponsor. They're providing all the tires for free, right? And it's not just a regular tire. It's an advanced tire they developed. It's got sensor technology in it, something they actually want to validate in autonomous vehicles. They want data on how their tires, you know, operate on autonomous vehicles.
So they actually have a tire specifically for an autonomous vehicle.
They have a tire that they've kind of put together for this competition, but more specifically, they have tires that have sensors in them that they're using in commercial applications. But they're particularly interested in: are there differences between the wear and tear and how those tires perform if a vehicle is autonomous versus human driven? I mean, in theory, maybe there's no difference, but you know, when you get down to really specific granular data, maybe there is a difference. And I think that's the kind of thing they're trying to determine. And our technology on our vehicles is incredible in the sense that, you know, we're getting real-time information about telemetry, about the engine, about all the different sensors, the supercomputer, you know, where the vehicle is at a very minute level using different perception systems in real time. There's a lot more data coming off these vehicles than is on an IndyCar, for example, and frankly, a lot more than is on even advanced vehicles that you or I might drive down the road. So the cars are over $1 million in value per vehicle.
Okay, so the data gleaned from this event, is this going to go directly to the ongoing development of autonomous driving technology?
Yeah, I mean, there are innovations that are taking place right now that have already improved core technology on these vehicles. Yeah, I'm not going to give specific examples because I don't want to give the impression that our sponsors' technology aren't outstanding, but the technology on these vehicles are bleeding edge, meaning that there's still issues that need to be worked out. And, you know, several of the systems and subsystems, hardware, software that are on the vehicle, you know, didn't function or didn't operate the way, you read the manual and says it's supposed to operate out of the box. And, you know, some of that may be the integration of that technology, but we're pretty confident that our teams, once they've got their hands on these things, have made stepwise improvements that have allowed those sponsors to get direct benefit that they can use to improve their commercial technology today. Then looking forward, yes, the data and the experience that's being gained, you know, these universities take that back. They further iterate on it in their labs and in their at their home campuses. And, you know, we're going to see, you know, improvements down the line in what research is able to do vis-a-vis automation as a result of this. And then I think one of the most important things we don't want to miss is the talent development, right? The top AI, machine learning, data science talent that has chosen to participate in this competition for the last 2 years, who is eating, sleeping, breathing this, who are living in Indianapolis and have been here since June, working 12, 14 hour days sometimes, you know, their experience level when they go into industry is going to be outstanding, right? No knock on their counterparts who didn't do this kind of a competition. But if I'm hiring talent and I know that the person I'm hiring was in the Indy Autonomous Challenge and figured out how to get one of these cars to compete and was under the stress and pressure and problem solving and teamworking that's required, you know, I'm going to have a really, really outstanding person that I'm going to be adding to my organization. So the talent development and where our race team members go in the future, the kind of companies they start or the companies they improve, you know, I'm going to be excited to watch that. We certainly saw that with the DARPA Grand Challenge. And our hope is that we can lure as many of those folks to stay here in Indiana.
Well, best of luck to you. And let's hope for clear skies.
Absolutely. Fingers crossed.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Paul. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you. Take care.
Okay, let's take a quick break and we'll hear from Michael Saxon of Black and Gold Autonomous Racing. This is the IBJ Podcast.
Hi, everyone. I'm Angela B. Freeman, host of IBJ's new podcast, The Freedom Forum, that discusses the intersection between business, race, and gender. Our third episode this month is with Jessica Gendron, President and CEO of the Center for Leadership Excellence, and she'll be talking about the disparities and inequities experienced between non-diverse and diverse women in corporate leadership positions. This podcast will debut on October 27th, 2021, and is brought to you by Cummins Inc. Hope to see you there.
All right, we're back with the latest edition of the IBJ Podcast. Let's hear from one of the teams in the Indy Autonomous Challenge.
I'd like to welcome to the podcast Michael Saxon, Managing Director and Team Principal of Black and Gold Autonomous Racing. Thanks for making time for us today.
Well, thanks very much for having me.
Let me ask you right off the bat, how are things going? Do you feel like you are ready for October the 23rd?
We are ready for what October 23rd has become. In many ways, this thing from the beginning was a bit of a moving target in the sense of what we think we or what we thought we might have been able to accomplish, you know, 2 years in the future. And I think the race format at this point is still going to be pretty compelling and interesting. And we're certainly ready for what that's become.
And what is your understanding of the format right now?
Well, I think we're going to be able to test. Like the vehicle has to be able to move autonomously from the pit lane out onto the track to be able to perform its autonomous laps, as well as some object detection and avoidance as well. It's looking like what's going to happen is the cars will move around the track. They'll do a time trial, and then they'll have to sort of navigate some obstacles, you know, on one of the straights of the track. And it'll be a combination of those things that I think ultimately determines the winner for this particular competition. The good news, well, I think it's the good news from all the teams' perspectives, is that it looks like we're going to do another race in January, and then we'll see what the future holds from there.
Now, you've been able to get out on the track and practice, is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, thankfully, we've had the support of both Lucas Oil Raceway as well as Indianapolis Motor Speedway. So, you know, track days are like gold in this series. And obviously, these tracks are in high demand for a whole host of events. So getting track time has always been, you know, an important part of this. And then Lucas Oil Raceway coming on board really has helped quite a bit, because that's multiplied the number of track days that we've had to be able to do testing and that sort of thing. So, yeah, it's been very helpful to have both venues assisting with this.
Have you been able to get around the oval?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We're up both ovals, as a matter of fact.
So tell me about the team and how it came together. Who is on the team?
You know, I was a career U.S. Army officer, and I was on the faculty of West Point for 10 years. And I retired from the Army in 2017, came back to Indiana, which was my, you know, my where I grew up, both my wife and I, and started my own business. And, of course, I'm very interested in technology, very in motorsports. I had done some work at West Point Autonomy, and I saw this competition and said, oh, this is fantastic. This is literally the fusion of everything I'm interested in. And so I reached back out to West Point, the Robotics Research Center there led by Colonel Chris Corpella. And I said, hey, does West Point want to do this? And eventually the answer was yes. And then I noted as well that Purdue wasn't involved, which was very surprising to me given both their proximity and their prowess as an engineering institution. So I reached back out to Purdue University. I reached out to Purdue University and really didn't know too many people there. And so I just sent quite a few emails around and happened to land in the right email inbox and was able to start a conversation and get them to join the effort as well. So it's been a joint Purdue-West Point effort for almost 2 years. And then within the last couple of months, we've also absorbed part of the team from IUPUI, which has been a real boon for us because there's a ton of capability there as well. So so right now we're a joint West Point Purdue IUPUI team, and it's a great team, a lot of capability.
So part of your job as a leader is to bring these people who don't know each other and programs, I assume, have different approaches sometimes, bring them together onto one goal.
Yeah, absolutely. And part of the challenge has obviously been, you know, the COVID situation. So a large part of this competition has been done remotely, only until, you know, the last couple of months we've been able to meet again in person. So it's really interesting, the case of our team. We did our kickoff event in downtown Indianapolis, where we're able to meet in person. And then, you know, that was what, March of 2020, let's see, 2020, I think. So, you know, since then we've done everything remotely, you know, had to do all that sort of team building and bonding and a lot of that kind of stuff that you would expect a team to do, and do that remotely and develop our code remotely. And obviously we spent a fair amount of time working in simulation as we developed our code and, you know, the original 39 teams sort of kind of whittled down to the ones that we have. But yeah, so we've had to do a lot of this from afar, and it's been a testament to the team's, I guess, wherewithal to be able to pull it off and meet all the objectives.
What does it seem like the students, for example, have gotten out of this process so far?
Well, I think a ton of things. I mean, first of all, I mean, it's an amazing technical challenge in the sense that we were given a car that is the technical hardware foundation is quite unique. It was very difficult for the, you know, the team that built our car to build it. But at the same time, we've had to develop the code for the car. And then, frankly, as we've deployed that code on the car, we've had to solve a ton of hardware challenges that, you know, you would expect you would have to to solve once you actually are applying code to actual hardware in a race-like environment. So a lot of our folks didn't have those sorts of experiences where maybe they were quite proficient in coding, but really not, you know, maybe low-level systems or some of the hardware troubleshooting and that sort of thing we've had to do. So it's really, I think, broadened the horizons of a lot of folks on the team who, you know, have just really had to wear many hats to basically solve problems. And that's what this challenge ultimately is about, is, you know, just to continue to push through every obstacle that the difficulty of the challenge itself is going to provide, and can continue to push and get closer and closer to objectives. So that's one of the things the team has achieved. And of course, you know, there's this larger issue of, you know, project management and people stepping into roles that maybe they don't traditionally step into. We've approached this team from the beginning as like a race team. And so we've brought on full-time marketing and creative and any number of other things from around the surrounding Indianapolis community. So we have folks that have done creative, for instance, for multiple race teams, including IndyCar teams. And we have, you know, a marketing team and various other sorts of individuals. So, you know, everybody's been able to see kind of all the facets of what a race team might look like, in, at least in our small way. And then, of course, overlapping this is this giant engineering challenge as well.
How different is this challenge from previous challenges focusing on autonomous cars? I mean, is this more of the same, the next obvious step, or is this really a big step forward?
Well, I think once these teams achieve what we hope to achieve, it'll be a giant step forward. I mean, it's an edge case for sure, but you know, we're really in a situation where as these cars increase in speed, you know, you're really on the outside edge of what computing is capable of. Specifically, you know, I mean, if you think about the specific challenge of this edge case, I mean, you have to operate at speed, and you have to be able to use the sensors, LIDARs, et cetera, cameras on the car, be able to process data in real time on the car, right? So you have to do all your, you know, you're already operating at, you know, a specific megahertz, you know, so you already have a specific amount of time that it takes just to process a signal. And then you have to send that through a network into an onboard computing platform, compute, you know, execute your code, you know, and therefore make decisions, and then send that back to the car, you know, drive-by-wire system for it to be actually able to respond. And as you might expect, as the speeds go up, you know, that the very physics of that process becomes the impediment. So I think as we test these cars fully to their limits and really get to high speeds, it's a pretty remarkable challenge. So I think it does push things significantly forward in that respect.
And because of the connection with a Purdue and IEPUI, for example, do you guys feel like you're kind of the home team? Do you feel any pressure in that regard?
Well, yeah, it sure seems like we're the home team. And you know, it's part of what I think motivated our participation in the first place, which was, this is our hometown. And, you know, we believe that Indianapolis Motor Speedway, you know, is the motor racing capital of the world, right? So if there's things like this going on around us, we need to be a part of them. And I think that's why it was such an easy sell for Purdue University. It was, you know, it was, I think, this moment where the right people at Purdue said, wait a second, we're not involved in this. And, you know, that just seemed to be an untenable position for the very reason you described. I mean, being part of this seems distinctly Hoosier, if that makes sense, right? It just seems distinctly motor racing, right? So it doesn't seem like something you can't be a part of if you're around here and mm-hmm. you've got some engineering chops.
What do you hope to get out of this here in the end?
Well, from my perspective, you know, this has just been the opportunity to do something that's, you know, I'm passionate about. I, you know, I've taught for a long time. I enjoy being around young people. And so, you know, it's an easy sell for me. For the students, you know, I hope that they just have the ability to do a very difficult engineering challenge, you know, that's also, frankly, pretty darn sexy. I mean, we're talking about race cars here. And so this takes a lot of what they're doing in a laboratory and puts it on a platform that's just really compelling. I mean, and so not only that, but they've got to work alongside UCOS Racing. So they understand a little bit more about how racing works and racing safety and how workshops work and how trackside behaviors matter and all these various things. I think this is fantastic to pull, engineers out of a laboratory, you know, and put them in this sort of environment. I mean, it's fast, and it's a, like I say, it's a race car. So that to me is amazing. And so, sure, that experience, I hope the young people profit from that experience. And to be honest with you, I would love for them to get some exposure, because, you know, we have some fantastic talents that work extremely hard, and, you know, they're all pursuing advanced degrees, that sort of thing, but they're all going to have to go back out at some point and, you know, get jobs in the tech community. And they're going to have, you know, decide if they're going to stay in academia and try to run their own laboratory and all those other things. And all those partners that have come on board as well, you know, our marketing team and others that have, you know, selflessly put time into this. It would be great if some of that could rebound on them as well, which, you know, I believe will be the case.
Are you worried about that first turn?
Well, like I say, it's a very expensive car. So I think everybody's concerned about the first turn and the second turn, the third turn. We're all concerned about pretty much, you know, every part of the track. You know, you think about all the times that something, you know, something small fails when you're making a smartphone call or something like that. And of course the stakes are pretty low there. You know, you might lose connection, or you may have a little pause or hiccup or something like that. But, you know, any little thing that happens with a car, whether it's our fault or it's just a hardware snafu or anything else, that can put a car in a wall. Like I say, it's a very expensive car. So it's a beautiful car. So we want to see it stay whole for as long as possible. So yeah, a little bit of nervousness across the board for sure.
All right. Well, best of luck. Hope to see you guys out there. It's going to be great.
We're really looking forward to seeing everybody that comes out. It looks like it's going to be a big day.
My thanks again to Paul Mitchell and Michael Saxon. You can read more about the Indy Autonomous Challenge on the front page of the latest issue of IBJ, a story by our Mickey Shuey. And before you get on with the rest of your week, there are a few other strong stories I want to bring to your attention. First up, outages at two of its power plants have forced AES Indiana, which you probably remember as Indianapolis Power and Light, to buy more than $1 million worth of power from other sources. And now it wants to pass that extra cost onto its customers. But consumer advocates and environmentalists are lining up to block it. IBJ's John Russell has the story. Also in this week's issue, Leslie Bonesia Muniz details the challenge of moving most of Marion County's criminal justice system from downtown Indianapolis to the new community justice campus in the Twin Air neighborhood. And Emily Ketterer breaks down the communities that have coalesced into regional development teams across Indiana to compete for $500 million in grants from the state. And their proposals include new facilities like concert venues and sports complexes, as well as talent recruitment, job creation, and housing initiatives. Again, you can find these stories in the latest print edition of IBJ or online at IBJ.com. I will say, it's quite a bit easier to access all of the latest local news about business and politics and all of IBJ's data on Central Indiana's business, community, and economy if you're a subscriber. It works out to about $2 per week for actionable information you're not going to find anywhere else. Just go to IBJ.com and click on the subscribe button. Thanks again for making time this week for the IBJ podcast, which is edited by Leslie Weidenbender. I'm Mason King. Hang in there, everybody. We'll be back again next week.